Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Mr. Khos at 7 o'clock. Right now, we are going to take a look at something. We've been doing this entire week. We've been taking a look at some really strange laws from around the world. Hopefully, we can unlock some unique insights. Sometimes things just simply don't make sense. And sometimes we learn something, right? So that's something we will hopefully get going. There was a law... there was regulation, rather, in 1992 that was implemented in Singapore. Interestingly enough, Singapore will come up later in our show again when we take a look at passports from around the world. But this particular piece of regulation that was implemented in Singapore was an anti-chewing gum regulation that basically... put in place a ban on chewing gum in Singapore. It is now illegal to chew gum in Singapore. The fine for doing so, or the penalty for doing so, is between $500 and $1,000 for your first offense and $2,000 for repeat offenders. And if you thought that was the crazy part, wait until you get into those that are selling a chewing gum illegally. They could be fined anywhere between $10,000 and $100,000 or 2 years worth of imprisonment. So next time you think about taking gum to Singapore, think again. You're tuning into the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. I'm your host, Jimmy Muyaha. And on the show today, we're taking a look at the Fly Safair story that's been in the news lately. It's been in the news all week. In fact, we're going to be speaking to the National Consumer Commission. They are now getting involved with a probe or an investigation into what has been making the rounds on social media. We've also got a bit of a commentary from Fly Safair themselves around the particular investigation that the NCC has has initiated. And we're going to speak to the NCC and try and get an understanding of where this puts users, or you and I as customers of Fly Safair, but also where it puts the airline and the aviation industry as a whole. Then we've got a conversation with 91's Peter Kent around the state of emerging markets and the outlook that they hold for emerging markets for 2025. And then we've got a conversation around passports. We're going to be speaking to Henley and partners around the strength of passports, what the most powerful passports are in the world, and how we rank them all. And then we're going to wrap the show up with a conversation with an SME. It is a Thursday. We always speak to SMEs on a Thursday, and it's the first Thursday of the year. It's also the Thursday before we go back to school. So our SME for this week is going to be back to school focused.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
We're going to kick things off, as we always do, with a sense of how the markets have been moving. I'm joined on the line by senior market analyst at XNest, Terence Hove, to take a look at the market movements for the day. Good evening, Terence. Compliments of the new year to you. Lovely to catch up with you. Markets seemingly having a better day today from a local front than they have had all week. Resources absolutely marching on today. Some standout performers there. What did you make of today's moves?
Yeah, I think... fairly better than what the week has been. But I think the biggest story that we're seeing also being played out in the South African rand is, you know, how markets have been spooked by yesterday evening's FOMC Fed minutes. And, you know, it's quite interesting that almost all Fed officials, you know, looked at the upside risks to the inflation outlook and mentioning that it's increased, you know, partly, you know, or mostly due to the stronger than expected readings on inflation. So I think the outlook for 2025 is what we're seeing, you know, leading up to Wednesday, you know, that expectation from the US Fed minutes, which is pretty much, you know, the sentiment driver, you know, amongst, of course, the Trump comments and assumptions and expectations that have been floating around the market.
Terence, those conversations from a Trump perspective have certainly been rocking the markets throughout this week, and we are expecting that they'll continue to do so. I mean, I believe the inauguration is, 11 days or so away for President Trump. So obviously we're going to continue to see volatility for the short term, but also probably for the next 4 to 5 years. How are you reading some of the other political things, or some of the other geopolitical things happening outside of America? I see the likes of Europe also going through a bit of a weird patch as well. The likes of China still going through some things. South Africa also not immune. How are you seeing the 2025 kind of landscape shaping up?
Yeah, I think if we look at the 2024 closure, you know, economies were starting to pick up, in particular in Europe, but it was dotted, you know. Germany still struggled. France had quite a lot of political unrests, and, you know, that tended to play out from the fiscal. So going into 2025, I think those are going to be the key focus areas, you know, with regards to the strength of the euro area. Yes, the ECB had started the cutting cycle. Also, I think they're trying to spur up that growth because they kept rates tighter for a little longer than they should have, I think, for the euro area. So it will be interesting to see how much further they are going to cut in the euro area, especially in comparison to what the US Fed's outlook is, you know, with regards to inflation and the risk outlooks have been increased going into 2025. So, you know, that suggests a possible hold from the US Fed and more cuts from the ECB, especially, you know, to really get the euro countries resilient. So I think we're starting to see a divergence in rates going into 2025 from central banks. You know, they're starting to diverge on their rate paths in comparison to the synchronization that we have seen in the past, 2 years or so.
Terence, I don't know if you took a look at the Rand today, touching 19 Rand, obviously a concerning level there. I thought we'd be closer to 17 or 16 Rand at this point. What's happening from a currency perspective, and why is South Africa on the receiving end?
Yeah, I think this is really a dollar story because we're seeing, you know, Rand weakness. We've seen quite, you know, a considerable drop, you know, in the commodity price, for example, in the price of gold as well. And you know, this plays to, you know, that dollar rand, you know, gold is quoted against the US dollar. So we're seeing a lot of that playing out in particular from a dollar story, you know, and again, you know, that sentiment driven by the FOMC minutes. So I think that the Rand really is getting the latter end of you know, emerging market sell-off, you know, on what is then expected to remain a very resilient US dollar, as you mentioned, going to 2025 and possibly the next 5 years. So I think that the Rand is quite elevated, very much under pressure at the moment. And I think leading up to these 11 days, as Trump, you know, gets into office, we're going to see the Rand fairly under pressure, you know, unless our own microeconomic prints, you know, come out stronger leading up to those 11 days. But it's primarily a US dollar strength story at the moment.
Mm. Terence, when we look at the local markets, we saw that the likes of the commodities counters, or the resource counters rather, having a really good day in terms of just movement. What surprised me was the movement on Sasol, up almost 8%, almost 9% for the day in trade. That stock's been under pressure quite a bit. And we are seeing that maybe investors at the moment might start to think that has been a lot or too much pressure. How are you seeing that, understanding that, of course, commodities prices haven't really moved in the favor of Sasol, but the stock has been under quite a bit of pressure since last year?
Yeah, it has been. So, I mean, Sasol, if we remember, when it also had, you know, that, you know, significant drop a few years back, but it bounced back quite considerably, you know, and very strong. And it shows Sasol's exposure to, you know, the global volatility, in particular in the oil commodity. You know, that exposure is strongly seen there. But I think supporting that jump, we're seeing that, you know, the prices of oil are already, you know, on you know, a more sustained bullish run, so to speak, you know, as they head towards that $75 a barrel figure. So I think It's playing significantly on that stock price as well. You know, just how the oil prices are starting to recover. And as they continue to recover, I think that will be reflected in the Sasol performance, you know, due to that correlation.
Mm. Terence, what has you excited for the year ahead from an investment point of view? What areas are you looking at? What is of particular interest to you at the moment?
Yeah, I think rates definitely. And, you know, to that point, how they're going to be diverging in the different markets. So I think so some value might be found there. But I think at the end of, you know, as we led to the latter part of last year, we saw some strong performance in the real estate sector. So I think it will be interesting to see that resilience go in and as hopefully the sub cuts some rates. They might not be as aggressive with rate cuts as anticipated before, but I think still as the rate cuts come in as well, that's going to give the consumer a lot more appetite. So I think that sector is got some very favorable value, including consumables as well, you know, the retail sector for consumers. So I think as consumers, you know, that tight pressure from higher interest rates begins to lessen, we're going to see a lot more consumer expenditure. And I think those sectors that are going to draw the immediate expenditure from consumers, you know, that real estate, retail, that's going to be exciting going into 2025.
Certainly lots to look forward to. The year is going to be a very busy one, as if this week hasn't been busy enough. I think we'll leave the conversation there. Terence, thanks so much for the time and for the insights. Terence Hove, Senior Market Analyst at Exynes, on some of the market movements today, as well as his thoughts for the year ahead.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Now, if you've been on any social platforms recently, particularly in this week on X, we would have seen conversations happening around FlySaf Air and the overbooking that recently happened that consumers recently experienced via the airline. It seems as though the National Consumer Commission has gotten involved in this. They are now investigating this particular event or these practices, and they're going to be taking a look at what it is that needs to be done from this perspective. We're joined on the line by the head of complaints and investigations at the National Consumer Commission, Prudence Moyeloa, to take a look at the developments around FlySaf Air and see what we make of it. Good evening, Prudence. Thanks so much for taking the time. What prompted the NCC's involvement here?
Yeah, as you correctly stated, we've been following the discussions on X and other media platforms regarding this issue. As you may be aware, the Commission has a responsibility to monitor consumer markets, just to pick out if there's any inconsistencies in application of practices that might not be consistent with the Consumer Protection Act. So we picked up on this discourse in the public domain, and we followed it, and we looked at it. And once we had a discussion, our inspectors looked at it and recommended for an investigation against FlySaf Air, and obviously the Commission has started this investigation.
Prudence, the practices that are being practiced here, they're not new. We kind of see overbooking taking place, not just in South Africa, taking place in various places around the world. The practice itself is technically not an illegal practice. I suppose it might be frowned upon in some areas of the world, maybe even in South Africa, but it's not an illegal practice. What are you looking to get out of this investigation? Are you directing your investigation towards anything in particular, or are you just saying, look, we're putting the consumer's interests first and we're going to uncover whatever it is that we find out from all of this?
I'd like to respectfully disagree with your first point.
Mm-hmm.
I think it still remains to be seen following our investigation whether or not it is consistent with the Consumer Protection Act.
Okay.
As a commission, obviously, we're looking at the provisions of the Consumer Protection Act while we do this investigation. What we are looking at is just the provision of goods and services in terms of Section 19 of the Consumer Protection Act. It is obviously a condition an implied condition in every transaction that whenever you enter into a transaction with a consumer and you take consideration from a consumer, the intention is to provide that service. Now, it's a provision under Section 19 of the Consumer Protection Act. Well, of course, there is a rider to that. If, for example, with an agreement that is anticipating certain practices, that might also be a qualification. But I think we need to be careful in making statements like it is not illegal to conduct certain practices before investigations are done.
Mm.
So we're actually looking at the provisions of the Consumer Protection Act when we made this decision to say there is a prima facie case to answer. Hence, we started the investigation. And we also looked at the provisions of Section 47 that talks precisely about pre-booking and overselling as well.
I'm glad you...
Overbooking and overselling. So it is very important that when we communicate such information, we not, create an impression that we're saying something is legal, but we're just looking at consumer interests without necessarily looking at why we began the investigation in the first place.
Mm. I'm glad you brought up the Consumer Protection Act. I want to play a small clip that we got from FlySafair directly, and I'd like to get your thoughts on what's being said here. I'm just going to play the clip now for us in a sec.
We certainly acknowledge the NCC's investigation and look forward to providing all the details that are required. We remain confident that our policies are transparent and very much within the bounds of the CPA, but we are imploring the NCC to cast the net wider and conduct their review across all airlines in South Africa, because all airlines employ this policy and a disproportionate focus on FlySafair alone wouldn't be fair.
So that was the voice of the spokesperson of FlySafair stating that they believe that they are within the bounds of the Consumer Protection Act, which you are going to be investigating. But they've also suggested that other airlines are doing this. So this is very much the industry norm, and that the NCC should be expanding its investigation to all parties and all airlines concerned here. Is that something you guys are looking at?
At this moment, we're looking at the practice of FlySafair. If other practices of other airlines are brought to the fore, the Commission will also obviously not turn the blind eye. FlySafair is well within their right to make suggestions to the National Consumer Commission on how this investigation must turn out, and that is exactly what it is, it's a suggestion. However, what we're looking at is actual practices that came about from the public discourse, and we're following up on that. We are investigating FlySafair and not the rest of the industry at this moment. So we need to be careful not to dilute what we're looking at this juncture. Let us look at the practice of FlySafair. If there are lessons to be taken from this particular investigation that perhaps widely industry might want to look at, then I think it's a win for all consumers. And also, if other matters are lodged with the Commission, like any other matter that can be lodged with the Commission will also follow up.
Mm. Prudence, before we wrap things up, I want to take a look at the consumer side of it. Obviously, in an effort to protect consumers, you will do whatever it is that the Commission feels is necessary for the betterment of consumers. Should there be better communication around these sorts of practices from an airline perspective? And are we overlooking something where it comes to the impact that this has on consumers? I mean, we shouldn't have to wait, surely, for these events to find their ways into the public domain before we look at them. Should there be something from an airline perspective, whether it's FlySafair or other airlines, that speaks to this more clearly and says these are the communications that you as a consumer need to be made aware of?
Now, it's not even about better communication. There are specific provisions in the Consumer Protection Act that says that suppliers have a responsibility to draw their attention to any provision in their policy or even terms and conditions of contract that might affect consumers negatively. When you look at the specific sections in the Consumer Protection Act that require plain and understandable language, that require fair contract terms, and how for fact or any kind of term need to be brought to the attention of. So it's not even about better communication. It's about legal obligation on the side of the suppliers. I think it's high time that all industries, including South Africans at large, understanding that consumer protection and provisions are not suggestions and are not just best practices. These are legal requirements that are placed on suppliers who provide goods and services in South Africa.
The law is the law and it needs to be enforced as such. Well, we look forward to the outcomes of the investigation and we'll certainly be keeping an eye on this as the investigations continue. I think we'll leave the conversation there for now, Prudence. Thanks so much for the time and for the insights. That's Prudence Moyloa, who is the head of complaints and investigations at the National Consumer Commission on the developments around the FlySafair overbooking conversations.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
As we kick off the new year, this being the first full trading week that we've had this year, I thought it might be interesting to take a look at what the rest of the year could have in store. South Africa is an emerging market. We've seen emerging markets be on the receiving end of a lot of pressure, depending on when you're looking at emerging markets. And I thought, why not take a look at the emerging market picture for the 2025 year and beyond? Joined on the line by Peter Kent, who is the co-head for emerging market fixed income at 91, to take a look at their latest emerging markets outlook that they've put up for 2025. Good evening, Pete. Lovely to catch up with you. Let's start with last year. Big election year, more than 50% of the world's GDP is going to the polls. We came out of that from a markets perspective relatively unscathed. I mean, it could have been significantly worse from a volatility perspective, but it seems as though we've kind of made it through the bulk of that with all the major economies not really surprising us here. Other than, of course, the US, how do you reflect on what happened last year from an emerging market perspective?
Thanks, Jimmy, and thanks for having me. I think the first thing I would say on all of the elections last year, we called it the year of the ballots, and it lived up to its billing. You know, if you recall, South Africa had its election in the middle of the year. India was around the same time, same to Mexico. The UK, the US, closer to home, we had Botswana, we had Mozambique. And I think the overriding observation that we saw last year was the incumbents got absolutely slammed. So, you know, either incumbents lost a decent amount of their majority or it completely flipped and went against the incumbent. And given the uniform nature of that phenomenon, you've got to think that there's an underlying reason for it. It's you know, obviously every election has its local issues, but you have to sort of think that there's a wider issue at play here. And I think and sort of market commentary, which I tend to agree with, is inflation played a major role. You know, and I think it's a little bit of a hat tip to central banks and monetary policy and trying to keep inflation under control. It's actually a virtue for politicians, because if you see inflation eat away at people's pay, they struggle for food, they struggle, you know, to live, they just notice prices going up and they want change. And I would say that is probably the biggest reflection on last year, which interestingly is quite informative on, you know, Trump version 2 policies this year. If you think that inflation was such a bogey for the incumbents last year, I think all politicians need to be very careful about stoking inflation this year.
Pete, let's stick with the bogeys. Trump coming back into office in the U.S., I mean, I don't even know how we described it the first time around. Americans went ahead and did it again. And that is going to bring about a lot of, it already has brought about a lot of volatility in the markets. He hasn't officially even been sworn in. And yet we've already seen him make sweeping pronouncements and statements that have rocked markets in the first trading week, effectively, of the year. What does Trump mean for the outlook or the risk to the outlook for emerging markets?
So I would say a couple of things. First of all, like, you know, his first term, I think the sentiment at the time was, you know, he sort of squeaked through and there wasn't really a mandate. It definitely feels that, you know, when you look at the numbers, the fact that he got the popular vote, it does feel, you know, when you speak to my American colleagues, it does feel like there is a mandate this time around. So, you know, whatever we had the first time, this time is going to be supercharged. And this time he's going to be more prepared. You know, the first time around, you got a sense and, you know, sort of reading on the subject, they kind of started at the inauguration, whereas this one feels like it's been planned for some time. And they're already, as you say, they're already sort of initiating policy proposals. I think the one thing as a market participant, I would say the kind of economic advisors he's put around him and the Treasury Secretary he's put around him are really sensible people. And, you know, whilst the threat of tariffs is one that's difficult for emerging markets who rely on trade, you know, he has some sensible people around him. So we lean on that. The other point I would make as well is this inflation phenomenon. Tariffs are potentially inflationary, especially on consumer goods. So if the Trump administration does an across-the-board 10% tariff for all countries and a 50-60% tariff on China on all products, which he mentioned on the campaign trail, you can bet your bottom dollar that's going to be inflationary. So that is opposed to that point that I mentioned first up, is no politician wants inflation here. So I think that is a constraint, first of all, on the tariff side of things. The other side, which is potentially unsettled markets, is fiscal. You know, developed markets have been borrowing. I need to be careful here, like a drunken sailor, in all honesty, for the last 3 or 4 years since COVID. And I think there was a big fear in the market that we were going to get, you know, it was bipartisan. You know, whether Democrat or Republican, you saw the deficit widen in the U.S. It was kind of at eye-watering levels, anywhere between sort of 6 and 10% over the last couple of years. And there was a fear that he was going to borrow even more as a sort of populist type agenda. Those sort of sensible people that he's got around him, I would call slightly fiscally hawkish. I think they kind of realize that they are at the end of the road of like sort of borrowing and spending. So, you know, they will look to mitigate that through cost reductions, through taxes. But, you know, you do have to sort of nod to history and think about Reagan. Reagan had this kind of agenda too. And the deficit did widen during his regime. You know, he sort of expected cutting taxes would result in more growth, which would actually result in more taxes, and sort of promised fiscal deficits to come down. That didn't happen under Reagan. So whilst you are hearing slightly sort of hawkish reverberations from the Trump administration on fiscal, you know, the proof is in the pudding there. So the market was worried about fiscal, lots of spending. They're worried about tariffs. And then they're very worried about dollar. The dollar is really, really important for emerging markets. You know, it's the other side of all of our currencies. You know, if you think about South Africa, dollar rand, for example, close to 19 over the last couple of days. If the dollar rallies, it's very hard for other emerging markets to do well from a currency perspective. It's a very high hurdle. And the U.S. economy is doing exceptionally well. It's doing exceptionally well from a productivity perspective. It's completely outpacing Europe, outpacing the U.K. There's no real competition coming from developed markets in terms of economic performance. So the dollar is doing well against those currencies. In fact, emerging markets are actually probably putting up the biggest defense. You know, we're the ones sort of growing at a reasonable pace and actually sort of defending somewhat against this really, really strong dollar. So I think that as an emerging market investor is perhaps the biggest worry that I have, is whether this America first, whether the dynamism and growth of the U.S. economy is something that's going to persist, and it's just going to be a hell of a hurdle to clear as an emerging market investor.
Pete, why is it that, and this is just off the back of what you've said around the dollar and countries like the United States increasing their debt ceilings and going into more debt and all of that, why is it that emerging markets are not allowed to do that? Why is it that only developed countries can come out, print money as they see fit, and say we're going to put it towards infrastructure, but when an emerging market does that, emerging market currencies get devalued? Isn't that how emerging markets become developed economies?
Yeah, it's a great point, and I would cast your eye on the UK at the moment. You know, the UK used to be a reserve currency. The pound used to be, sterling used to be a reserve currency. It used to be the reserve currency. You know, when you look at what the UK is doing at the moment and how sterling is traded and how gilts are trading at the moment, you know, they're kind of losing that luxury at the moment, and it's because they run a massive current account deficit and a capital account deficit. Now, that's a technical term, but essentially what it means is from both a trade perspective and a capital perspective, they rely on the kindness of strangers. And, you know, the kindness of strangers is often a function of economic prospects in your country. And if you don't have any, you don't get that kindness, and your currency has to devalue to attract it. You know, the best way to attract capital is to make things hell of a cheap. And that's kind of what's happening in sterling at the moment. Now, the U.S. has this significant privilege of being a global reserve currency. It has the world's largest liquid deepest market, so it can cater for that. You know, South Africa couldn't be a reserve currency. Its markets and the supply of rand is just not enough, right? But then the U.S. has got these strong institutions. It's got strong rule of law, and people use that liquidity, the strong credibility from the Fed in preserving the value of the dollar. And as a result of that, they have this reserve currency status. Now, it's an interesting point because we as emerging markets look at this as a privilege. But the corollary of this, the other side of the coin of this, is exactly Trump's agenda. So what you have to do to become a global reserve currency like the dollar, you've just got to export a bunch of dollars to the world. And how do you do that? You do that by essentially outsourcing all of your industry and all of your manufacturing to the rest of the world. So the rest of the world gives you product and you give them dollars and they use those dollars as reserves, right? Now that has been the sort of chimerica, the China-America relationship post-WTO. That's been the relationship for 20, 25 years and it's not worked for the U.S., right? Their sort of industrial sector, their rust belt has been deprecated. You know, there's a lot of sort of middle Americans looking for work, you know, trying to sort of figure out what life means to them. And that's kind of part of his campaign. That's part of his manifesto. So when I sort of mention up front that the dollar is perhaps my biggest concern as emerging market investor, just like inflation is diametrically opposed to what Trump is trying to do because of the political risk, a strong dollar is diametrically opposed. If he wants to reconstitute that manufacturing sector in sort of middle America, he needs the dollar to weaken, right? He needs to essentially reverse this 25-year phenomenon. So that sits in the back of my mind. You know, on a sort of near-term cyclical basis, the dollar looks very strong. You've got high cash rates. The economy is performing well. There's the threat of tariffs. But I know in the back of my mind, it really doesn't help Trump's agenda of trying to reindustrialize the U.S. So in the back of my mind, I'm sitting here going, I wouldn't be surprised to see the dollar actually depreciate over the year, but I'm struggling to see the path to it.
Pete, where do the emerging market opportunities lie then? If China's going through its own mess, the US is focused on the US, Europe is going its own way, where do the opportunities lie and how do we make the most of it from an investor point of view?
Well, it's exactly that, right? It's exactly what you say. We have had a world for the last 20, 25 years where, you know, there's been global cooperation. We've had world trade where people have optimized their sort of supply chains to the fifth decimal place across the globe to sort of like cheapen products. We're unbundling all of that. And, you know, Trump isn't the person. COVID, it was almost happening pre-COVID. COVID was a real wake-up call to all of us that, you know, you need things of national importance manufactured locally because the moment there's trouble, people shut their borders and don't send things across borders. So you're essentially having a rewiring of supply chains, right? And those supply chains are going to be brought onshore. You know, the U.S. is saying it from a national security perspective. They need steel production. They need manufacturing production. You know, they need to make their own weapons and their own syringes and all these kinds of things. So there's a rewiring of supply chains. So sure, the last 20 years is not the blueprint for the next decade. You know, the last 20 years has been one where essentially China produced everything and, you know, we all bought it quite cheaply. So there's a rewiring of the supply chain that's happening. And everyone thinks it's bad for emerging markets because China's not going to grow and China's not going to produce anymore. But that stuff still needs to be produced. And it ain't going to be produced by America tomorrow. And that stuff still requires raw materials. It still requires commodities. So what I think people are doing is they're sort of conflating the problem here. They're conflating a rewiring of the supply chains and a change in the last 20 years in something that's bad for emerging markets. It's just different. I think it's different, right? So we've got a world where it's going to be more inflationary. There's going to be more demand for stuff. You're going to need some risk premium in your assets. I mean, that is emerging markets for you, right? Like that's emerging markets for the last 20, 30 years. We've had to deal with inflation. We've had to deal with political risk. You know, we've had to deal with exporting commodities, these kind of things. So I think emerging markets are being sort of unfairly punished by global investors. I think they deserve a place at the investment table. They're a cyclical asset. You know, the globe is growing. You know, the probability of recession is sort of decreasing. China, whilst it's not growing well at the moment, you know, China's been sitting on a deflationary bust for the last couple of years with what they've done to the housing market there. You know, they're sitting on a housing market sort of bust at the moment. And if they weren't careful, they were going to end up as Japan. They were going to end up as the periphery, where they didn't ease policy enough. They've woken up to that risk. So the last 6 months, they've started to ease. So you don't sit here going, wow, you know, China's really sort of solved its secular problems and China's like a fantastic sort of top-down place to invest. But certainly the worst case scenario has been managed. So, you know, it's not going to be a drag on emerging markets. And whilst China struggled the last few years, emerging markets haven't noticed it because we've kind of rewired our supply chains. We've rewired our sort of economies. So I think emerging markets offer you premium. They offer you value in a world where there's not a lot, whether it's equities or bonds. And I think they offer you a diversifier. And I cannot remember in my 25-year career of investing a time where diversity is more of a virtue. With this kind of world that you mentioned right at the beginning, where who knows what is happening, do you really want your eggs in one basket? You want diversity just to avoid the losers, to be honest. And I think emerging markets features quite prominently in that.
I couldn't have put it better myself. Emerging markets is the place to be going into 2025. Investors out there that want to bring their dollars, euros and other currencies to emerging markets, South Africa's here. We're ready. We're open to receiving these funds. I think we'll leave the conversation there, Pete. Thanks so much for the time and for the insights. That's Peter Kent, who is the co-head of Emerging Markets Fixed Income at 91 on their Emerging Market Outlook for 2025.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It's just going up to 6:42. You're listening to the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb, and we're taking a look at the Passport Index produced by Henley and Partners. It's an index that's produced quite frequently by the team at Henley that basically outlines the most powerful passports in the world. I'm joined on the line by the director for the director at Henley and Partners, Lisa Chepek, to take a look at this latest index. Good evening, Lisa. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's start with passport power. What is that and how do you calculate it?
Hi, Jimmy. Thanks very much for having me this evening. It's an absolute pleasure. So passport power is basically every quarter, Henley & Partners publishes the Henley Passport Index, which ranks 227 passports according to how many countries they can access. So how many countries passport holders can travel to without having to obtain a visa. The data we use is obtained from the International Air Transport Association, which happens to be the world's most accurate database of travel information. So really, passport power is calculated on how many countries one can enter without having to obtain a visa.
Lisa, when we look at some of the movements on the latest index, I want to look at some of the normal things, or the seemingly normal things. I think about the likes of Singapore returning to first place. For years, every time I've looked at this index, they've always been in the top three, usually in the top position. They've returned to that position. Take me through some of the movements and where countries are ranking. I'm particularly interested in looking at countries like Canada and the United States, where the United States has for many, many years told everybody around the world that they are the best country in the world at everything that they do, and yet they are struggling to make the top 10 here.
Correct, Jimmy. Very interesting indeed. So, you know, despite the US being the world's leader in private wealth creation and accumulation, Americans can no longer take stability for granted as they have done in the past. So, you know, with political divisions and societal tensions at an all-time high now, American investors, entrepreneurs, wealthy families are now actually looking for a plan B in record numbers. So America has, in fact, become Henley & Partners' biggest market over the past 12 months or so for clients looking at an alternative option. You know, they're using it as an insurance policy, just hedging against the instability in the US at the moment.
Lisa, what about some of the other insights from the Passport Index? I found it quite interesting that we speak about the strength of passports, we're ranking all the countries around the world, and we're saying that the main thing here is which countries can you get into, or how many countries can you get into without a visa, and yet on the point of visas, we still see that countries, particularly African countries, still continue to face this concept of visa racism. What's happening there?
Yeah, absolutely, Jimmy. So, you know, research reveals that while globally only one in six Schengen visa applications is rejected, the stats show that one in two African applicants are rejected. Furthermore, African applicants are twice as likely to be rejected as Asian Schengen visa applicants. So according to Professor Maru from the John Hopkins University, he sees this as a result of factors extending beyond purely economic factors. You know, weak economies and coupled with discriminatory policies based on identity and culture explain the high rate of rejection for African Schengen visa applicants.
Lisa, when we look at the state of the visas and we look at just the overall trends that we're seeing, you touched on some of these trends earlier around the fact that United States citizens are amongst the highest in terms of applicants for secondary citizenship and those sorts of things. Are we seeing some trends for the 2025 year going forward around travel, perhaps, that might be suggesting where individuals might be looking to leverage off of passports? Are we perhaps looking at a growth in sort of passports being obtained for investment purposes or for those secondary citizenship purposes?
So I mean, Henley & Partners is a global organization, but from a South African perspective, you know, we certainly do see trends over the years in terms of the most popular programs that clients are looking at investing in. And it does change, you know, the programs do change. Portugal has always been a really popular program for South African clients, but there's been a lot of changes there over the past 18 months or so. So there's a bit of stability that we're seeing created there now going forward, and we're going to see, more interest in Portugal again going forward. The Caribbean countries have also always been interesting for South African clients from a global mobility perspective, you know, that ease of travel. South Africans, although our passport currently ranking 53rd on the passport index, giving us access to 106 different countries sounds like a lot, but you know, there's no Schengen access, there's no UK access. So those are the countries that your Caribbean passport would allow a South African to invest into, say a St. Kitts or an Antigua passport, and then have that flexibility of the global mobility to enter those countries for up to 90 days at a time, without having to obtain a visa.
Mm. You touched on South Africa, Lisa, and I want to look at where we, I mean, obviously you mentioned we rank 53rd on this particular list. Where do we rank on the African continent? And are we seeing kind of an increased interest in perhaps other African countries looking to adjust their policies and be more welcoming? I know South Africa, for example, has wanted to explore the idea of saying that certain countries, when they come here, might not need to have visas. So we're looking at visa-free entries, the likes of Ghana saying they're willing to offer a passport to every or any African individual that seeks one. Are we seeing the shifts from these countries rather to open up their borders or to close down their borders? How is that shaping up the index, and how is that shaping up perception?
So to answer the first part of your question, where do we rank in terms of Africa? So in fact, the Seychelles is the number one ranking African country on the Henley index, with Mauritius in second place. And South Africa takes up the third spot as far as Africa goes. So we up there, but, you know, it's we're not on the top step. And, you know, as far as increasing our access and our, you know, our position in the global ranking, so to speak, we need to be more open to there needs to be more openness to other nationalities, you know, and you know, you touched on Ghana and various countries looking at policies to do this. So, you know, there is talk about it, and it is becoming more and more of a trend, and important for countries to feature with more openness and friendliness between borders. So it's there's nothing groundbreaking that's happened or imminent to happen that we know about at the moment. But certainly, you know, there is always movement on the index. There's fast fallers, there's fast climbers. Dubai, for example, has been really strong over the past 10 years, climbing up the ladder over 72 positions in the last 10 years. China as well, also a real big climber up the index. And the US is one of the biggest fallers.
Certainly lots to think about, especially if you are looking at exploring the idea of a second passport or perhaps looking to travel and looking to see which passports might be beneficial for that. I think we'll leave the conversation there, Lisa. Thanks so much for the time and for the insights. Lisa Chepek, who is a director at Henley & Partners on the latest passport index that suggests that South Africa is the 53rd most powerful passport in the world.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It's a Thursday, it's SME of the Week time, and with schools opening next week, why not take a look at a small and medium-sized business that has a direct impact on schools around the world? We're joined on the line by the co-owner of Totem Bags South Africa. They manufacture school bags in South Africa. Zach Osters joins us to take a look at their business, get a better sense of what it is that they do beyond just the bags. Good evening, Zach. Thanks so much for taking the time. I remember the name Totem from my days in school many, many millennia ago. The bags looked very, very different to how they look now. Clearly, the business has been around for quite some time. Is it the same family-owned business that I remember from my days?
Hey, Jimmy. Yeah, thanks for having us on. Yeah, like you, primary school for me was back in the Stone Age. So it feels like the business has been around for a long time. And correct, yes, the business was started in the late 90s in South Africa by my mother, who had the idea to sort of bring in a school bag that provided parents with an opportunity to buy something that was of quality. She looked around and saw what was available for us as children, realizing that there wasn't much available in terms of quality choice, and that was kind of the genesis for the brand back then.
Since then, Zach, the brand has obviously undergone a lot of change and evolution. And from a business perspective, I mean, I imagine your mom was running the business at some point. You are now co-owner and director within the business. And evolution from a product perspective, but also from a growth and a management perspective. Take me through the journey of how the business has kind of gotten to where it is today.
Yeah, so over time, I mean, the landscape changed in South Africa sort of as e-commerce became more and more available to sort of SMEs. I guess the original sort of genesis of the business was distribution into major groups. So, you know, our first customer was the likes of Pick and Pay, and, you know, we've grown distribution into them and all the other major retailers in the country. And that was kind of phase one of the business. Phase two was then sort of building out our own distribution online, building out a web page, back end, adopting the various platforms in, you know, that are available in South Africa, like Takealot into the business, and then really trying to balance being both a retailer and a sort of an online retailer and a sort of wholesale distributor. So having to wear sort of both hats has been an interesting journey, but I think it's one that applies to many businesses today now that the sort of direct to consumer model has really kind of, you know, found its feet and settled in.
Zach, let's take a look at some of the offerings that you guys now have. I mean, we traditionally know the Totem name for school bags, but you've kind of expanded into things like pencil cases, lunchboxes. Take me through what the full product range looks like now.
Yes, I think we're customer driven. So we try to get feedback from customers and figure out what else in the range is something that they're looking at, and there sort of the natural expansion was into accessories that match the product. The focus all along with the product has been quality. So we've been wary to tread into SKUs and subcategories where we can't manufacture something that we would gladly put our name on. So we've expanded into sort of matching sets and trolley bags and some accessories, some maternal bags, some trolley bags for smaller kids. So we're always experimenting. But the core range is really the school product, and you know, that's the bread and butter, and that's where we aim to keep our customers happy, and anything else around that is ancillary. I guess when we put ourselves in the shoes of the customer, comes back to school, there's 1,000 problems to solve. And we find that if parents can come onto our website or visit us in store and in one swoop pick up a whole bunch of product that matches and ticks the box from a quality perspective, it's just one less thing for the parent to think about, and that's kind of the problem we're trying to solve.
Mm. Zach, let's talk about the actual bags themselves that you guys manufacture. Do you manufacture everything locally? I imagine you've got quite a large staff contingent locally, given how long the business has been around. But how are the bags made? What's the process like there? What are you guys doing there?
Yeah, so as much as we'd love to make the bags in South Africa, unfortunately, we don't have the manufacturing capability to produce this kind of product at this scale, at this price. So, you know, we work with a long-standing manufacturing partner abroad who's we've been working with for 20 years, and that's the kind of symbiotic relationship. We do all the product design, and they assist us with the manufacture. We may look down the line as things improve in South Africa, and we find manufacturing capability locally is something we'd love to do. But at present, we manufacture abroad, but all sort of design, distribution, marketing is all handled locally by our South African team.
Zach, take me through the distribution locally. You say that that's handled locally, but I see you guys also have things like resellers. Take me through where people can get hold of your products. You mentioned a store earlier. You mentioned online. Tell us all of those details around the people that, or the parents out there especially, that want to get access to Totem backpacks, trolley bags, and all those other good things that you guys have. How do people get in touch with you?
Yeah, so nationally, we're across the major groups. We're in Pick n Pay, we're in ShopRite, Walton's, P&A, and the likes. JD Group has come on board recently. We've also got long-standing relationships with kind of regional independent stores and stationers that are, you know, servicing particular schools and particular catchment areas. Those are listed on our website. I think we service close to 100 of them sort of nationwide. So there's always somewhere nearby where a parent can walk in, and you know, sometimes buying online, you know, you don't get the ability to sort of touch and feel. And when we're selling a product of quality, we think our bag does better when somebody actually holds it in their hands and gets to feel and assess the quality by really sort of handling the product. So we always believe that retail, physical retail, is going to have a home for us. And then aside from that, we're engaged on Takealot. We sell there, and then we've got our own website at totembags.co.za there, where people can buy direct from us.
Speaking of that quality aspect, Zach, what about the sustainability of the business? I mean, I know there's been quite a big focus around sustainably sourcing things. We've seen that from various types of companies, but it's also something that you guys hold close to your hearts. Tell me about what you guys are doing there.
Yeah, so sustainability is an interesting one. We some of our products we use what's called an RPET, which is a PET fabric that's made from effectively a recycled plastic source. So we've experimented with that over the years. For us, really, the main way we see sustainability impacting is around buying quality. So, you know, we think that buying something that lasts, not something that is in the sort of fast fashion bucket, is how we make a mark. You know, we've got many anecdotes from thousands of customers over the years of people who have bought their bag and used it for, you know, we've got a 3-year guarantee, and they've ended up using it for, you know, for years past that. So our view on sustainability is not creating the waste in the first place. You know, I think we live in an age of fast fashion where, you know, people are buying stuff that's really made very cheaply and finds itself in the garbage heap, you know, after, you know, a single hand number of uses. So we're trying to make stuff that lasts, and that's our sustainability angle, by just producing something that doesn't land up in the rubbish heap within a few touches.
Quality, sustainable, school bags readily available for you as we kick off the new schooling year. I think we'll leave the conversation on that note. Thanks so much, Zach, for the time and for the insights. That is Zach Oster, who is the co-founder at Totem Bags, joining us for this week's SME. If you're looking for that business, it is Totem, as in T-O-T-E-M, bags.co.za. They've got their bags on that site, but they've also got them on Takealot and other platforms. All the best to you and your business, Zach, in this year and all the years going forward. It's just gone 7 o'clock. We've come to the end of our show and the end of our week. It's going to be a busy 2025 from a business perspective, and we're looking forward to a lot of things. But for right now, we're going to cross back to Greg Hose and the SAFM news team for the latest round of evening news, followed by Michael Abramson and the Top Sport team. From my side, good night.